Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. Today, the topic is national health care. It made headlines earlier in, about a month ago, in early March. Obama promoted a new program that is being introduced. It's a subject that I wrote about. I wrote about what he thinks of as national health care or health care reform. And apparently it's considerably different than what most people would think of. My guest today is Dr. Oliver Fine. He's the president of Physicians for a National Health Program. It's an independent, nonpartisan, voluntary organization supporting universal, comprehensive, single-payer national coverage for all. Every Western country has this except one. We know which one that is, and that's the problem, and it has to be changed. Dr. Fine is a general internist. He's also a professor of clinical public health and the associate dean for affiliations at Weill Medical College at Cornell University. Dr. Fine, are we connected?
Yes, indeed.
Oh, Oliver, welcome to the program. It's a big issue.
Thank you so much.
Oh, it's a big issue for you, and it's a big one for me. And I must tell you that going back a number of years, I thought it was a bad idea. Well, we all make mistakes, and over time I realized that it's not at all a bad idea. It's an essential idea. And about 15 months ago or so, I had one of your predecessors on. I had Steffi Wohlhandler come on, and we talked about it.
Very good.
Well, it's a big issue, and people, I think anybody without insurance understands what an important issue it is. And we're getting dangerously close to 50 million people in this country without health insurance, but it's a lot worse than that, because maybe on the order of 80 million at any time or other during every single year doesn't have health coverage. So they better hope that when they get sick, they do have it. If they get sick and they don't have it, they better hope it's minor stuff, because if it's major, they're in very, very serious trouble.
That's what I like to say, Steve, is that, you know, you're one major illness away from realizing how underinsured you are.
Oh, indeed. It's the major cause of personal bankruptcy in the country.
That's correct.
People get into a health crisis.
Personal bankruptcies are due to medical expenditures, and 75% of the people had health insurance at the outset of their bankrupting illness. Absolutely astounding.
And what's happening today, of course, is we're going through an absolutely devastating economic crisis.
Right.
And we're leeching jobs.
You know, jobs lost every day. Since we're the only industrialized nation that links health insurance to employment, that means that 14,000 people a day are losing their health insurance.
It really is shocking. I've heard all kinds of statistics, like a job lost every 5 seconds. And we've discussed in this program, and discussing the economy, Oliver, that music means a break is coming. I'll just get one thought and we'll take a break and then come back.
Okay, great.
The true number of job losses a month are far, far higher than the reported numbers that are completely rigged. It may be on the order of 1 million jobs a month being lost, but the Labor Department doesn't want us to know that. We'll come back right after the break.
Okay, very good.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Dr. Oliver Fine, and we're talking about national health care. Oliver, let me let you pick up where we left off and explain from your experience and your work at Physicians for a National Health Program just why this is so important and why listeners really need to be attentive to this. Even doubters no longer will be doubters the moment that they get a pink slip. Then they'll be believers.
Well, yes. I mean, I think that the situation with healthcare coverage is really, again, becoming a major crisis in the country. I think the issue is really what is the solution to this? We in Physicians for a National Health Program feel that the evidence for a single-payer national health insurance program is increasingly becoming overwhelming. So what is really that proposal? Essentially, first and crucially, I think, it's that it's a proposal for universal coverage, but it seems like everybody now is in favor of universal coverage. Even the private health insurance industry seems to say, well, you know, there should be an individual mandate that everybody buy their product, and that's what they mean by universal coverage. What we mean by universal coverage is that essentially the enrollment should be automatic. Let's say you present to an emergency room and they do their usual wallet biopsy, ask if you have health insurance, and they find that you don't have health insurance. Well, we'll just sign you up right there in the emergency room. Or you get admitted to the hospital and you don't have health insurance, but we'll just sign you up right there in your hospital bed. Is there any private health insurance company that would sign you up when you were in the hospital or in the emergency room? No. That's why you need a single-payer kind of program where there is automatic enrollment. Does that make some sense?
Oh, absolutely. And the government needs to take the lead, Oliver, in assuring that, well, we need a government that really serves all the people. Very sadly, the government that we have and that we have had for so many years really serves the special interest, the business interests of the country. I think Calvin Coolidge said it very well back in the 1920s, the business of America is business. I think what he really meant by that is the business of government is to see to it that business does as well as possible. And not too much attention is paid to the needs of people. That certainly was the way it was back then. And the only time that we really saw anything remotely close to change were two periods in the 1930s, New Deal, and again in the 1960s, the Great Society. We never got health insurance from the New Deal. We got Social Security.
That's right.
Monumental achievement. But there were discussions about National Health Service. It never went anywhere. And even Lyndon Johnson, 1965, Medicare, for some reason they came up with this idea that only elderly people get sick, not young people. So they came up with Medicare and forgot about everybody else.
I think what happened there was, you know, again, this phenomenon that most people got their health insurance in the 1950s and 60s through their employment. But then the problem came, what happens when they retire, right? And that's the time when most people might even need their health insurance more, but in this country, when you lose your job or you retire, most people lost their health insurance. So Medicare was a way of trying to plug up that particular hole. And the private health insurance industry on one level, you know, realized that this is the most expensive population to cover. So they were really interested in only covering those people who were healthy, because that's the way they could make the most money. So Medicare was a way of filling that gap, actually.
If I remember right, you may know more about this than I do. It's been a long time since I've looked at it. I believe that that company-paid health insurance came about initially during World War II. Is that right?
Well, yes. I date it actually with about 1936 when Blue Cross was formed. Blue Cross in those days was a nonprofit company that covered only hospital care. And that rated its premiums on what we call community rating, where every employer got essentially the same premium charge. And then along came World War II, and wages were frozen, and unions could not bargain for wages, but they could for fringe benefits. And health insurance and pensions were the two things that they really could bargain for, and they did. And it's what I call the accident of history, that health insurance gets linked to employment during World War II, and then the Internal Revenue Service comes along and says if the employer contributes to the purchase of health insurance for his or her employees, the employer can deduct that from their taxes. And this is what really firmly weds, you know, health insurance to employment. And we really became the only industrialized nation in which that happened. Most other industrialized nations, if you lose your job, your health insurance continues because it is seen, frankly, as a social good.
The situation for working people back then began to get much better as well, Oliver. In 1935, we got an historic labor act, the National Labor Relations Act.
Yes, that's right.
Wagner Act. It really empowered labor for the first time ever.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it was attacked instantly, and it's been eroded terribly ever since. But workers really had some power in the early 1950s. Oh, about 35-36% of working people belonged to unions. Union bosses, they weren't perfect. There was a lot of misdoings, corruption, whatever. But there were some people who at least did the job of representing the rank and file, whereas today it's just so totally different. I have a new article out today about the UAW and the destruction of auto worker rights and so on, a separate topic. But working people had power. Good contracts, labor contracts that were enacted. Companies actually had pensions. My goodness. Now we have self-funded 401ks.
Right.
And if you put them in the wrong investments, then you have maybe half of a 401k. Over the past year or so, the way things have gone. But it was a much more favorable environment for working people way back then when I was growing up in the late 30s, 40s, and 1950s. And I must tell you this, I've mentioned this on the air before. As a grad student at the end of the 50s, for 1 year I took out a health insurance policy to cover me over until I went to work and a company would give me insurance. And I got what I thought was a pretty good plan that would cover me for anything important for 1 year, 12 months, and it cost me $100 and change.
That's pretty amazing.
Mike,
you can't get that
today. I don't know that I could buy a week's coverage today for that.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely.
Things have changed. And because of all of this and the absolute iron grip that the insurance industry has over healthcare, along with pharmaceutical and the big organizations, I guess American Hospital Association, I guess it is, the big players, they have an awful lot to say about what goes on. And there's no question in my mind that what's being concocted now in Washington under the so-called rubric of reform. Reform to me always means watch your wallet because they're about to extract something from you and claim it's a good idea. They don't want to talk about national health reform. You went to the White House forum, I believe.
Yes, I did. On March 5th, after quite a bit of grassroots support, and a threat of a white coat demonstration outside the White House, They finally did invite John Conyers, who's the author of H.R. 676, one of the, you know, actually it was kind of the major single-payer bill in the House, had over 92 co-sponsors in the last Congress, and yet he was not invited to the White House Conference on Healthcare.
Unbelievable.
On healthcare. So both he and I ended up being invited after a lot of grassroots support. So that we really appreciated. However, the event itself, you know, was, I think, you know, very, very highly choreographed by the Obama administration. But it did communicate certain very clear messages. One was that, you know, Obama was, in fact, approaching this a little bit differently than the Clintons. He was trying to, you know, be transparent. The whole conference was, in fact, on C-SPAN. He was trying to show that he was being more bipartisan because he had both Republicans and Democrats at this summit.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Dr. Oliver Fine. We're talking about national health care. Apologies, Oliver, that break does sneak up on us. I wanted you to get in every word possible, but you got cut off in mid-sentence. If you remember exactly where you left off, please pick it up.
Well, what I was saying that was that the Obama administration was trying to communicate that they were, in fact, approaching this issue of health care reform very differently from the Clintons. And that they were being both, you know, transparent, bipartisan, and finally, that they were really going to rely on Congress to, resolve the contentious issues, and, so, you know, this, in many ways, the, summit was rather disappointing in terms of giving us any sense of the direction of where things will be going. That was a little bit disappointing.
I think summits are basically, as the saying goes, for show and not for dough. It's really theater for the public more than anything else to convey the feeling that the administration really cares. It really wants to do something about this. It recognizes that this is a big and growing problem. So people are lulled to sleep to think that, well, they have a get-together for a day or two, and it makes headlines, and then it goes away. We haven't heard anything about this since it happened. And, of course, what really is going on behind the scenes is that the health industry is as strong as ever. And I must tell you that repeatedly, Wall Street, Obama has top officials and top underlings behind those officials. They represent all of the important special interests in the country. I've written about nearly all of them. I think I've missed a few. Late appointments, I didn't include. I wrote three articles about them, but they were late appointments that hadn't been made, so I didn't know who they were at that point. But it didn't surprise me in the slightest. But you just go right down the list of all the names that we've heard and many that many people don't know about because not too many stories in the news about Tom Vilsack, the agriculture secretary, or people in other top posts. But these people very much represent the power structure of the country, no different than the way it worked under George Bush or the way it worked under Bill Clinton or the way it worked in past administrations. And Obama very, very much, the people more than anybody else who put Obama in office were the financial people, the financial interests, the Wall Street people. They put up tons of money. Lobbyists put up tons of money. They knew what they were getting. This process went on for many months. And I must say that Obama repeatedly has told Wall Street that he will cut social benefits. starting with the big ones, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
Well, that certainly is a potential, but it seems to me, also important at this point to see the possibility that there is a chance to move ahead on some form of health care reform.
Well, I think there is.
I think the single-payer approach, again, gives us a way of talking about how to change what's going on. And I just wanted to make one further statement about that. And, the notion in single-payer is that we would move to a entirely publicly funded approach. And the difference here is that we presently have in the employment sector essentially a premium-based approach. And the premium-based approach is fundamentally unfair to people because the president of the company, whose income is very high, pays the same amount of premium as someone who's the secretary in the company whose income is much lower. So a single payer allows us to move towards a system that would be publicly funded either through a payroll type tax or an income tax that allows really for the cost of health insurance to be scaled much more to people's income.
Oh, indeed. And, of course, a system that doesn't deprive people of choosing their providers. I think a lot of people get scared.
That's absolutely right. And the private health insurance now really restricts you to a network of doctors, a network of hospitals that they have negotiated contracts with, whereas the traditional Medicare program really does give you access to the broadest group of doctors and hospitals.
Well, Oliver, I am on traditional Medicare. I've been on it for the past 10 years, and I must say it works. It works. I choose my own providers. I can go to anybody I want, avoid anybody I want. And thankfully, I haven't had much in the way of serious things to be concerned about. But
well,
the things
I've had
one knee joint replaced. that was a big deal.
That's a big deal. Yeah.
But I went to my own provider. I went to my own hospital, and I must say that Medicare handled all of the bills that came through without a hitch. Without a hitch, it really worked great.
Now, we need Medicare for all.
We need Medicare for all, exactly. We need to take another break, and then there'll be one more after this. We've got half the program left. We'll be right back.
Okay, great.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back. I'm on with Dr. Oliver Fine. We're talking about national health care, Medicare for all. Oliver, this is a battle that, like any other battle, if it's waged long enough and hard enough by enough dedicated people, it can be won. Many months back, I had a program on a wonderful book written by a wonderful woman who was called Challenging Authority. Frances Fox Bivens wrote the book, and she went back in our history and wrote about four times when the impossible was achieved. Major changes happened, again, because enough people put enough muscle into it over an extended time. And my goodness, I mean, we ended slavery in this country, thought impossible way back when. Well, my goodness, if we could end slavery, why can't we provide health care for sick people?
Right. And, you know, slavery was probably as fundamental to our economy, if not more, than health care. One of the arguments people say is that health care taking up 16% of our gross domestic product is so large that there's no way that we could get to, you know, a single-payer system when you have that much of the economy invested in one sector. Well, we did it with slavery. We can do it with health care.
Oh, indeed. The other big ones, she mentioned the American Revolution. I take a little issue with that because we have the aristocracy here battling the aristocracy in the U.K.
The U.K., yeah.
And a marvelous book that I read way back and wrote about was that really nothing much changed except we just had new management under a very similar system. But we got a constitution. We didn't have a monarch. We got a constitution. It's nowhere near as good as people like to believe it is, because people aren't told the truth. But we got it, and the founding fathers had their faults, but I'd sure trade what we have now for what they were back then. And in the 30s, we had marvelous things happen. I plan to do an article. I'm well into it, comparing FDR's first 100 days with Obama's.
Oh, interesting. That would be great. But let's go back to single payer for just a moment, though, if that's okay. Because, you know, we've talked about, you know, the advantages of it from the point of view of automatic enrollment and public funding. But the other reason that we are so convinced that single payer is workable and important is that it deals with the administrative costs of our present system. We estimate that close to 30% of every healthcare dollar is wasted on the administrative expense and profit that goes to private health insurance. And one of our big points is that, you know, if we moved from our multi-payer private health insurance system to a single-payer publicly financed system, we could save, you know, a large portion of that 30%. And what that would allow us to do is to provide, you know, coverage for people who are, you know, uninsured now, and also give people who are underinsured, who have high deductibles and large copayments, you know, better policies. And we could do that without costing the overall system a great deal more. So that's one of the things that makes single payer really politically feasible, it seems to us, is that it's something that really makes a difference in terms of these administrative costs.
Oh, absolutely. It just makes sense right down the line. You could come up with a checklist like you may have done, Oliver, and you just go right down the line, and it just makes such eminent sense. My goodness, we spend per capita about double any other country, and yet we rank way, way down the list in one health category after another with the World Health Organization has us in rankings, and
right.
My goodness,
we were 37th out
37th
of 191
overall
nations back in the year 2000. And actually, the Commonwealth Fund just did a study that they released showing us to be 19th, actually, out of 19 industrialized nations in terms of health system performance.
Cuba.
So,
we
have a situation where quality is very variable, so that you certainly can get some very high-quality care in the United States, that's no doubt. But the problem is that not everybody can get it, and that it is not uniform across the country. So that's another dimension that we think single-payer would be able to address. Certainly better than, you know, for-profit private health insurance, is the improvement of quality in the system.
Oh, absolutely. A country that is of great importance to me, Oliver, is Venezuela. Since Hugo Chavez became president in 1999, they wrote a constitution so different than ours. They wrote into it, they mandated by constitutional law that every Venezuelan will get free health care. Every Venezuelan will get free education up to a PhD or an MD. Now, just imagine that, not just the government passing laws to this extent, but mandating it in the Constitution. Well, I mean, there's nothing like that here. And way back when we had, on education, we had state schools that you could go to either tuition-free or pretty close, and all of that is gone. And, of course, the cost of health care has gotten so, so expensive. It simply is out of reach for so many people. Incomes have eroded in this country since the 1970s. They have not kept pace with inflation, and we've discussed this several times on this program. So incomes have gone down. Costs have gone up. I don't think any two costs have gone up more than health care.
Health care, yeah, no. Health care premium costs through an employer have gone since the year 2000 up 87% to 88%. Whereas, you know, general inflation has essentially gone up about 18%, and workers' wages have only gone up 20% since the year 2000. So healthcare is taking a much larger bite out of workers' earnings than it did 8 years ago. So it's, again, another reason to be quite concerned about, a system that would get rid of a lot of that administrative waste, the middleman of the private health insurance industry. Now, a lot of people have expressed concern to me about, well, what's going to happen to the jobs of those people who are in the health insurance industry, the ones who, you know, push papers and deny claims and so on and so forth. So in H.R. 676, we have put in a, this is the Conyers Medicare for All bill, we've put in a jobs retraining program for those people who might be displaced because they were in the paper-pushing side of the health insurance industry. So it's another important thrust that we've been involved with.
I'll give you an analogy. It's not completely apt. At the end of World War II with today, we had come out of the Depression. World War II brought us out because we put everybody back to work, and the factories started humming again, not exactly making productive consumer products, but they were working and people were working. Well, we had 10 or 12 million people in the military. There was a lot of fear in the country. My goodness, when the war is over, these people are going to be unemployed.
Well, so there was a GI Bill of Rights.
Oh, we had a GI Bill.
And well, that's what we're proposing here would be kind of a bill of rights that gives people the opportunity to retrain or to get further education paid for, to do those kinds of things as we transform the healthcare system from the multi-payer base that we have now to a single-payer system.
We very badly need a new direction in the country. We're going through a terrible economic crisis right now, but instead of directing the nation's resources to mending things, what really is going on, and this has been a feature topic again and again on this program, we literally are looting the national wealth and handing over to the very people, the bankers, the financial institutions that caused this crisis. That is producing nothing. That is not producing healing. These institutions are doing nothing. They're preying on the economy. Another topic, and it'll be reviewed again, is these people don't produce things for the country. They extract things from it. They act like parasites, predators. What we need to do, the latest figure I've seen, I may shock you with this number. This comes from Bloomberg. This was, I believe, the end of March, I think the 31st of March. They published a number. I had an article. I had $12.5 trillion either handed over to to these interests are pledged or guaranteed in some form or other. And Bloomberg upped me by $300 billion to $12.8 trillion. That's what we know about. I don't know what we don't know about. But, of course, we're stealing the national wealth, which means from all of us, to hand over to people who will use this money to create more mischief, not to heal the economy. It's a very ugly story. Just imagine if we used a small percentage of that and did productive things like provided health insurance for everybody. My goodness, that alone will go a long way to getting the public on the side of an administration that so far is doing nothing for people most in need.
Well, that's one of the real dilemmas, and that's why advocacy at this point for a single-payer national health insurance program, a program that's like, Medicare. Medicare does need to be improved, it should be said. Better coverage, less co-pays and deductibles, better reimbursement reform. Those things are really what may help transform this system from being so oriented to the private health insurance industry. You know, there's really no other industrialized nation, again, that relies as much on private health insurance as we do. Don't actually have more than 25% of our population covered by public insurance, whereas most other countries have close to 100% of their population. So we're kind of an outlier nation in the world, and that's what we would like to change by moving towards a single-payer national health insurance program for the United States.
I think one thing that we might ask our representatives in Washington, why don't you give everyone the kind of plan that you give to yourselves?
Well, that's a very risky statement, okay, because, the Federal Employee Health Benefit Plan is actually nothing more than access to private health insurance. I don't know if you realize this, Steve, but probably close to 8 to 10% of federal workers cannot afford the amount that they have to pay to buy the Federal Employee Health Benefit Plan.
No, I didn't know that.
The federal government contributes only 72% of the cost. The rest of it is paid for by the employee himself or herself. So, this is going to be posed as the public option. You've heard of this phenomenon, the public option. Well, one idea of the public option is let's give everybody what the members of Congress have, the Federal Employee Health Benefit Plan. Well, that is not doing anything that's going to benefit people because all it is access to private health insurance offered through what they would call a health insurance exchange, which allows you to compare the different private insurance is probably better than you could do otherwise, but it only gives you private health insurance.
Am I wrong? I thought
we want people to be able to have a Medicare-like program where there is automatic enrollment, the funding is public and therefore scale to people's income, where you get rid of the, middleman, the private insurance middleman, have access to comprehensive benefits, and free choice of doctor and hospital. You're not going to get that with the Federal Employee Health Benefit Plan.
Well, I agree with you right down the line, all of us. Correct me if I'm wrong. I thought members of Congress had a separate gold-plated plan for themselves.
No. They're on the FEHBP.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I was wrong. I thought they really had something very, very special that basically covered anything imaginable in the area of health care.
Only if they decide to use, the military hospitals, like the Bethesda Naval Center. Okay, that will give them total coverage. That's true. But they... fundamentally what they have is the Federal Employee Health Benefit Plan, and they can buy a private health insurance policy through that plan.
Well, I was wrong. My goodness gracious, I was wrong. I would not recommend a military hospital. I'm a veteran. I'm entitled to veterans benefits. I've been to a VA hospital in Chicago. It is not the hospital that I rely on to get my health care.
Yeah. Well, it's, again, a controversial area because the Veterans Administration has actually had quite a bit of improvement over the last decade or so. I remember being trained in veterans hospitals when I was in medical school, and certainly there were major problems. But what's happened since then is that they have put in a computerized medical record system so that all of the VAs speak to each other. They are able, like the Medicare program presently is not, to negotiate directly with pharmaceutical companies. So they get, the Veterans Administration institutions get the lowest price for drugs in the United States today.
I've gotten some prescriptions filled from them, and it's a far cry from the full price. We need to take another break, Oliver, and then we'll come back for a final segment. We'll be right back.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. We just have a few minutes left. All over the hour, it goes by so very fast. I want to mention your website, and I'll let you wrap up with some concluding thoughts and comments. But listeners can find your site. They can either Google Physicians for a National Health Program or www.pnhp.org, pnhp.org. Find out about your organization, the issues, what you're doing, why it's important for everybody, and really stay current on this extremely important issue that most people don't think about if they don't have a problem, but they certainly do when something comes up. But let me let you finish.
Okay, well, thank you. I think it's important that people have an opportunity to look at the issues. The website is an excellent source of many articles and pieces of information about the whole health reform debate. I would finish off by saying, you know, we're presently, there's a lot of discussion in Congress around this issue of, quote, the public option. And as I mentioned earlier, I think we've got to be very careful not to fall into the trap of thinking that the Federal Employee Health Benefit Plan is a real public option. A real public option, it seems to me, is one that would be Medicare-like, could be in some ways offered through an employer, and is something that there might be automatic enrollment in. Now, we in Physicians for a National Health Program don't favor the public option because we really don't think it will solve the major problems facing the American healthcare system. It's only a single-payer plan that will really do that. And so I want to once again say, you know, what are the features of the single-payer plan? Well, it's public funding so that we get rid of the notion of premiums, automatic enrollment, administrative savings so that the overall system doesn't cost more than the present system by moving from multiple payers to a single payer. Comprehensive benefits. You want to be sure that everything is covered from prevention to doctor to mental health services and hospital services and even nursing home services. And that all of this publicly funded system would be privately delivered, so that what we're talking about is something that really does resemble the way the Medicare program is structured today. We're not talking about, importing something from another country. We're talking about something that Americans are familiar with if they're over 65 and are heavily satisfied with, usually.
And I repeat again that I am on Medicare, and aside from the fact that they keep jacking up my premiums every year.
Yeah, well, that's on the Part B side.
On the Part B side,
that's how we could improve Medicare, is by getting rid of that component of it, because you're right. Those premiums have gone up, and that's a problem for many people who are elderly and on fixed incomes.
Plus the need to have a Medigap supplement to fill the holes.
Coverage isn't adequate. So those are things that are not,
Oliver,
I'm afraid
I have to interrupt. We are out of time. They'll break away momentarily. I just have time to thank you for coming on. This is a major issue, and we will review it again. My great thanks to you for spending the time with us this morning.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Thank you very much, Oliver. Yeah. And we'll be back again tomorrow. Join us then.